Thanks for listening to this Word in Your Ear podcast. If you'd like to get early access to all our productions ad-free, priority booking for our live events, and to take part in our weekly quiz, go to patreon.com/wordinyourear for more details.
You're listening to a podcast from The Word.
The first time I think I met our guest in the podcast this week is probably about 1976 or something like that. And I was working for a small record company, and we needed to get a very simple radio ad done. And somebody said, go round to Island Records and ask for Steve. He runs the studio out the back.
Right.
And so I went there and did this ad, and that was my first time I met Steve Lillywhite.
Well, hi there, David.
So, I like to say that I was produced by Steve Lillywhite very early on in my career, but it did not quite as successfully as U2 and, I don't know, Big Country and the Rolling Stones and God knows all sorts of people. So it's nice to meet up again.
I have to say that I don't really remember that.
No, okay.
But I don't think it would have been 1976, because I started work at Philips Studios in 1972, and then I didn't move to Ireland until 77. And during the reason I worked at Island Records was that when I was at my first studio, I did some demos with a band called Ultravox, who were called Tiger Lily at the time, who were sort of a everyone says, oh, yeah, mid-year. But I said, no, it was a different group.
Dennis Lee.
Dennis Lee, who then became John Fox. And
Just in that.
All right, we're okay.
Yeah, we're fine. Yeah. Carry on.
Dennis Lee became John Fox, and they changed their name from Tiger Lily to Ultravox. And it was... and actually, that was the first time I met Brian Eno. Because it was... the band said, we want Steve to work on our album. And Island Records said, who's Steve Lillywhite? Quite rightly, because I was 22 years old, working at a studio. And they said, well, you know, can you get Brian Eno? So anyone who's worked with Brian knows that he is a fantastic guy, a fantastic producer, but he will just come in and do his thing, then he'll leave while we do a lot of the meat and potatoes, you know. But that was when I first met Brian, and he was fantastic, and we got on well. Next time I saw him was on the Joshua Tree, which was quite a step up. Yeah, slightly more successful. But Ultravox was a good starting point for me, and it was, you know, it was sort of punky, roxy music or arty punk, you know. And I always preferred my punk rock to have an art bent,
right?
Because I was never a fan of the sort of UK Subs and those sort of punk bands. You know, I like melody always, and I like the art side. And but how I got my first break was my roommate. I was living in West Ken near the Nashville Rooms, and my roommate was he's since passed, but he did artwork for Island Records for Eddie and the Hot Rods and stuff, and I just engineered Do Anything You Want to Do and sort of co-produced that song.
Of course, everybody forgets Eddie and the Hot Rods for about 3 months were the biggest
band
in Britain.
They were almost the biggest band in Britain, yeah.
They were.
Yeah, but they had a manager called Ed Hollis,
yeah,
who was not named after the band, but he was the manager, the producer, and the lyric writer.
Oh.
So, you know, but the band still couldn't quite understand why he was always making more money than them.
Oh, really?
And it was, yeah, and... but yeah, he was a good man. But Johnny Thunders happened, who was in a band called the New York Dolls. He came round. He was friends with my roommate, and for some reason, word on the street was that this band, the Heartbreakers, he was in, that their album was not well produced. LAMF, it was called, yes, and yes. With some great songs like Chinese Rocks, and you know, some all questionable. I mean, I won't talk about
content,
but
not wholesome.
Not wholesome. No.
Never wholesome. Never accused of being wholesome. Heartbreakers.
No. So I said to Johnny in my way, I'll do the Heartbreakers or whatever you want, you know. And there was this wonderful guy called BP Fallon who was Johnny's manager, and he said, well, look, let's do a solo album. Let's get these wonderful people who are on the scene. So that was the first time I met Chrissie Hynde, who happens to be...
So this is Johnny Thunder's solo record.
Called So Alone.
Which was on Real Records.
Real Records,
which is why, which is Chrissie Hynde's label.
Chrissie Hynde's label, right. So that's how I got to know Chrissie Hynde. And, of course, so we had the Sex Pistols, Steve Marriott, Phil Lynott, Peter Perrett from The Only Ones. There was talk of Jimmy Page coming down one night, but he just never showed.
Right.
But it was great, and I sort of put this album together that had a few good tunes. This song called You Can't Put Your Arms Around a Memory that is as good a title as any...
It is.
Probably any song.
I've got that record still at home.
It's
And I held on to it mainly for the title, really.
Yeah, exactly.
So it's a charismatic title.
It's a great title for a song. Yeah. And it has actually been covered by a few people as well. Anyway, I'm doing Johnny Thunder's album, and who, I'm talking about all these people, and they're all dead. And this is a sad thing, but the manager of Susie and the Banshees came down the studio to hang out.
Neil Stevenson.
Neil Stevenson, who listened to it and said, oh, I like that drum sound. Would you like to do our first single? We've recorded a version of it. We don't like it. So we need to re-record it. I said, and I knew enough to know that as long as I made a decent version of this song, it would be a hit. Because at that time, Susie and the Banshees were up there, you know, with the Clash, Sex Pistols.
But not signed. Have they been? There'd been a real campaign to get them signed.
Right, but they know at this point, I think they were signed to Polydor.
Okay. You're right.
They were signed to Polydor.
By Chris Parry.
By Chris Parry, yep, that's right. And, God, we're old.
Can't remember what we did yesterday, but no, Chris Parry signed Susie and the Banshees.
Yes, and Real Records, yeah.
Yeah.
And so I went in and cut Hong Kong Garden, and all of a sudden it was, you know, I knew it would be a hit because there was like a wave of, you know, bands who were in the music press at the time would get a hit record.
Yeah.
And I have to say, it was a damn good record. And this was even in the days before the single was... You know, the band said it's really uncool to have the single on the album. So I then went and did their first album called The Scream.
Right.
That did not have Hong Kong Garden on it.
Which, in retrospect, a mistake?
Someone thought that because they laced it on later
editions.
Put it on
later.
But it was... I mean, Hong Kong Garden was quite a shiny pop record. And the rest of the album, there were no more singles on it. You know, Suburban Relapse and all these things, really. But it was a great album.
Yeah.
And so then I was in. You know, I had...
So suddenly you had two hits, or three, or two.
Yeah, well, it was... It's like
You want to do, being a hit?
My name wasn't really producer on that. I did a lot, you know, but... But it was like, it's like a catch 22. When you have a hit, you get the work. But how do you get the work unless you have a hit?
Yeah.
And all of a sudden, I snuck in through the back door on this wave called punk rock. And as I say, punk rock as punk was a great attitude, and I still stand by the attitude. But as a musical art form, it was limited. So, you know, when I was offered XTC and the Psychedelic Furs...
So is that what came out to us?
These, for me, excited me more than working with, you know, the UK subs or the Lurkers. Even though I actually did a song with the Lurkers.
How did you find those kind of groups in the studio, the punk groups in the studio? I mean,
The members...
Oh, yes, of course.
My brother was in
Your
the members.
Your brother was in the members.
And so I did the...
Sound of the Suburbs.
Sound of the Suburbs, and the not quite so... But still...
Offshore banking business.
Which, let's face
good
it,
record.
Is pretty relevant for the times
I
at the moment.
I suppose so, yes.
And Mr. Nicky Tesco was writing for Music Weekly.
Oh, wouldn't be surprised. Yeah, I think he's around doing
still,
that kind of thing.
Yeah.
So you were doing a wide range of stuff.
Yes, I've always used my success to not work with a similar band to the band I got the success with. Because I thought, I've had a hit, I'm on people's radar, so I'm not going to go and do another band that sounds like my hit band. I'll use the success to try to spread it. So I did Joan Armour Trading. And very early on, I did Walk Under Ladders.
Oh, of course.
This is the thing. You remember the things, but do you remember them in the order?
That came after a big hit, a breakthrough record, wasn't it? Was it Glyn Johns produced that breakthrough
record? Yeah, well, she had...
Love and Affection.
Love and Affection, still one of the great songs.
Yeah.
And Willow, a great song from that. album as well.
Down to Zero.
Yeah. And I did... my album was really good. This was after I worked with Peter Gabriel. Let's talk about that. There was a time, you know, so I was doing all these, you know, having a few hits. And I got this call from this woman, Gail Coulson, who was Peter's manager at the time, and said, Steve, you know, we'd like you to meet with Peter Gabriel. Now, I thought this was a friend of mine calling up to make a joke, because up until that point, everyone I'd worked with was my... had started when I started. Mm-hmm. You know, we all were sort of rebelling against what came before.
Or pretending to,
but, you know, actually, that's the thing, yes. But Peter Gabriel was... definitely from the era before,
even though the age difference wasn't much.
He's at that age, at that time
it seemed a lot.
Yeah, how old is he now?
I don't know. He's going to be 62 or something like that.
Right, he's 5-6 years older than me.
Okay,
and but so we went in, and he had this idea to make a record without cymbals. And
that was his idea.
No, that was his big idea for the record, because he didn't want it to sound like normal drums. And
do people normally have those kind of self-denying ordinances when they go into make records? Do you get because Peter Gabriel's doing this thing at the moment, isn't he? Where he doesn't have percussion on records at all.
Right, like
his current orchestral record.
So boring.
Well, you might say that. I couldn't possibly comment. But anyway, he's always had that idea. Yeah.
I think any artist, and I'll cite Bono as probably the best example of this, is when you get the big picture idea right. And I've always said this, I'm just changing the subject completely, but with U2, when they get the big picture idea, like the Joshua Tree, it feels like the desert. Act on Baby feels like Eastern Europe. Now, the fact that it wasn't really recorded all at Hansa Studios, like, you know, I mean, it was... because I was in Dublin when we were doing it, but it doesn't matter.
Yeah.
You know, it's all an illusion. But the feel of Acton Baby was Eastern Europe, and that. The feel of All That You Can't Leave Behind was somehow returning, a sort of home, you know, coming back to your roots.
Yeah.
The feel of No Line in the Horizon was Morocco, and I don't think they quite got it right, but I won't say any more about that. I got told.
So what are you saying? They start off with big ideas of how they want it to be.
Yeah, yeah. Well,
there's almost a visual image about
that. And I think great art is... can be great with those sort of limitations. I think limitations are great for art.
Right.
One might say that, you know, you could... musicianship can cover up a lot of inadequacies in songwriting, because you make it sound like fancy instead of trying to make it work... How can I say this in the diplomatic way?
You don't have to be diplomatic at all.
No. One of my best friends in the world, Adam Clayton, you know, is a fantastic boom, boom, boom bass player. And they have to really make, you know, he did slap a little bit once on the October album, I think. But really, you know, you have to really make a great record with the sort of limitations of what the band have.
Right.
And I also work with a band called Fish, who actually, in a big American jam band, probably the best musicians I've ever worked with. And in a way, their problem is just as bad, because they can do anything. You know, it's like, what should we play?
Well, I remember reading a quote years ago from Martin Rushent, who died long ago.
Yes.
Who said he'd worked with Keith Emerson, and he'd worked with Phil Oakey, and he thought Phil Oakey was a better musician.
Yeah.
Because he could decide,
right,
out of quite a limited palette, what he wanted to do.
Oh, absolutely.
Whereas if you can play anything,
the danger
is you do play anything.
No, exactly. Yeah. No, you're right.
So how was Peter Gabriel to work with?
So Peter was fantastic. Even though the album is as dark as fuck and really doomy, the making of it was full of joy. Lots of table tennis and...
Where were you doing this?
We did it... Well, that album actually probably paid for Real World, but at the time there was no Real World. There was just Peter had a barn.
It's down in the West Country.
Down in Bath still. You know, he lived in Bath. He had a barn. And we got the Manor Mobile, I think it was, and we went and parked it in the field. And we just, you know, made music there but this was the first time I'd worked on something that was a long project. Because Peter... even in those days, was not the most prolific of lyric writers. So he would take, like, 2 weeks off. You know, so we'd all go back to London, and I'd zip off and do a Psychedelic Furs album.
In between?
In between.
So you could bash out a Psychedelic Furs
record. Yep. I was reminded a couple of years ago that we did the first Psychedelic Furs album in 11 days or something.
Really?
This is why I've got such a pretty extensive discography, because in those days, you know, you could do records quickly.
Why could you do them quickly then?
Well, a lot of it is the lack of choice that you had. You know, there weren't so many choices. So you...
Technologically speaking,
there weren't many choices. And it was a more innocent time, I think.
So you got a good drum sound and...
Yeah, we got a
and
good...
you performed it in the studio.
Yeah, and I loved, you know, people say to me, oh, you know, what about arrangements? Do you do much of that? And it's like, I don't... I'd rather do as little as possible.
Right.
Because I love working with great musicians and steering great musicians. You know, I have no ego and I don't want to say, I'll make you a star, kid. No.
Right.
I want you to be really good and carry me with your career.
So you did XTC.
I did Drums and Wires, Making Plans for Nigel.
Right.
Black Sea.
Black Sea's a great record.
Yeah, with Tales of London, Respectable Streets and stuff like that. And that was when I got... And then I did this very strange documentary, because my timing is, like, I can't remember the
chronology,
but there was a clue, because I did there was a TV show which was as much an infomercial for Richard Branson and Virgin as it was really the making of Towers of London.
I see.
It was made by BBC Bristol, and it was a weekend at the Manor recording Towers of London. Now, a lot of this hour-long thing, which I've just recently found, a friend of mine bought a bootleg copy in Japan and he burnt me a copy, and it's me just sounding like this.
Yes.
It's like, and the fifth member of the band is Steve Lillywhite, and I sound a bit more plummy than I do now, actually. My accent's changed.
What was they like to work with?
XTC were fantastic. I mean, Andy Partridge, genius. I mean, no question, one of the top... You know, in boxing, they say pound for pound, the best fighter.
Yeah.
I mean, him, pound for pound, one of the best creative people I've ever worked with. And it's...
But they were pretty combustible.
Not in those days. There were no drugs. There was no... You know, the things that combust a band, women and drugs, there was none of.
Right.
Or excessive religious views.
Right.
Or anything that you would say... There was nothing. They were like country bumpkins. They would have a pint down the local...
So when bands start out, you're saying that they're just concentrating on the dynamic of the three or four of them or whatever.
Yeah.
It's only when they get the trappings later on or the distractions.
Well, it depends which band. I mean, because most bands tend to start out carefree and having a laugh. And then when success comes, they get sort of... paranoid and stuff like that. The one absolute exception is U2, who started out paranoid and not talking to anyone and very dour. And, you know, success really suited them. They turned, they maybe because they grew up in public, but, you know, Bono became his dad, joking and laughing and having a laugh, you know, and they're all great, really good like that, you know. None of that Ivory Tower stuff, you know.
So, when you were first asked to produce them, you didn't think they were a very promising prospect, did you?
Well, this is what happened with U2, if you remember. There was a bit of a buzz about this band in Ireland. So, A&R men, in their pack mentality, all went over for the gig. And it was... I wasn't there. It was apparently the worst gig. because they got the music papers on their side, it was a really bad gig. So, the pack mentality that went there suddenly became the pack mentality that went
away.
We're not interested in this band. So 6 months went by and they managed to just about squeeze a deal with Blackwell at Island.
Really?
Oh, yeah, because...
There was no great enthusiasm.
No. Who did they have? Island Records had... You know, they were the label of Bob Marley, Steve Winwood, and maybe the Buggles. You know, and... So U2 were... You know, they hadn't ridden that punk wave. I mean, they had Eddie and the Hot Rods.
Well, Ultravox as well.
And Ultravox, but not Senna's.
The Jags,
exactly. Yeah.
So the island didn't go into it thinking, this is the future.
Absolutely not, because, I mean, you know, and this is where Paul McGuinness is a masterstroke, because the manager, he thought globally right at that beginning. But, you know, in those days, if you'd looked at U2's contemporaries, Teardrop Explodes, Echo and the Bunnymen, this is like the second wave, really, of, you know, like punk had done its thing, and now we're on the next, you know, we're into 1980, like a couple of years later. And, you know, if you put Teardrop and Echo and the Bunnymen and U2 were like, you know,
Just another.
It's like the two-tone bands. My money was always on the Selector. I would have lost out.
you would have bet wrong.
Yes, I would have bet wrong.
So I didn't sign them. So somebody approached you about producing them.
Yeah, well, no, this is what happened. Martin Hannett.
Oh, of course.
Another dead one.
Yes,
Joy Division and factory staff producer, really, and king of the Marshall Time Modulator.
Oh, okay.
Which was a great studio piece of equipment, which gave all those Joy Division sort of tunnel-y sounding things, you know, and he was great at that. I always used to go into a studio and after him and just plug something through without changing the buttons.
Whatever it was.
Because, you know, you never know.
That was his secret.
Yeah, but he always changed it. but anyway, he was paranoid. But he did U2's first single, which was called 11 O'Clock TikTok. And the band were happy with it. They wanted him to do the album. And then, and this is where I've always said, but I'm not sure if this is actually true, but I always seem to remember at the time it was when Ian Curtis committed suicide. And this freaked out Martin Hannett. And he was not in the right frame of mind to produce U2 at the time that they needed to make their album. So, although I'm not sure if this is exactly right. But anyway, something happened, and U2 went back to their list of producers, and I was number two.
Right.
So, thank you, Ian. so, I got the job. I went over and recorded a single, and they liked it, and we went and did Boy. And at this point, I was still under this thing that I should only ever do one album with a band, because I can work with lots of different bands, but bands should work with lots of different producers. So, you know, for the second album, I said, you know, great, you know, it's done okay. In America, they've got a foothold. They certainly toured like crazy, because McGuinness got them to tour like crazy. And they said, no, we'd love you to do the second one. And I went, okay. And then we did October, which was a lot darker and a lot, you know, it's that old thing, you know, you've got how many years to write your first album, and they had no time to write the second one. So they were playing catch up. So when it came to the third album, I said, of course you should write, you know, you should work with someone else. And they said, yeah. So they went away and they worked with a guy called Sandy Pearlman. They did some recording.
Blue Oyster Cult,
exactly. And that was not very successful. And basically they phoned me up and said, Steve, what are you doing in September? And but a very interesting fact was that after October, the record company, not Blackwell, who was the owner, but the president of Island Records, wanted to drop them. And Blackwell just had this thing that they had a spirit. Because Blackwell's always said to me, you know, he feels guilty about his, how much, you know, what he's done from U2, because it was, you know, he says he didn't do anything. No. Unlike Marley, where he really worked Bob Marley. Yeah, he produced the records, he took him from just a great Jamaican songwriter, but made those records timeless. There's no question about it. Very, very great.
Whereas U2 became part of the island myth, didn't they?
Yeah.
And it need never have happened.
No. This guy wanted to drop them, and Blackwell just said, give him one more try.
Right.
You know, there's something about this band. So we went in, and as I say, we cut New Year's Day and Sunday Bloody Sunday, and I remember Bono in the studio saying to Edge, in the way only like family members can say to each other. You know, it's like, don't fucking do that. You know, don't play like The Edge. Play like Mick Jones from The Clash. You know, because Edge is very much the scientist who'll just fiddle, you know. And Bono was wanting him to be more direct. And
So did you detect from your early working with them that they had clearly had something special, that they had kind of staying power and that? And
yeah, I mean, Bono was always a great singer. You know, for me, it's always about the singer more than the song, really.
Really?
Yeah, because I don't know about you, but I can hear a song 5 times and not get it. And then I can hear it a 6th time and go, "Ooh, I love that song. Who is that?"
Right.
Oh, right. I've heard that. Yeah, but with a voice, I can absolutely. I never change my opinion about a voice.
Right.
You know, I'll either like a voice, and I always like it, or I'll dislike a voice and always dislike it. You know. So I. You know. So when I'm listening to demos, that's the sort of thing I listen for.
So it's his voice that struck.
His voice. Yeah. Yeah. He had great voice. I mean, the musicianship was good, and Edge, of course. You know, I mean, I'd been a fan of Marquee Moon by Television, so I was thinking, well, he's just copying, you know,
right,
a lot of Tom Verlaine's
lyrics. Yes, yes.
But you know, I mean, apparently, and this is a quote from Edge, and I don't remember it, but apparently I said to Edge, "Well, do you have any other guitars?" You know, he goes, "No." So we did the whole first album with a Flying V, you know.
Right.
He didn't have any other guitars. And Larry's dad used to come and collect him from the studio, and, you know.
But they had a kind of maturity about them, didn't they? Or were kind of, well, they were unflappable, and
they were so. It was very. You see, people nowadays don't realise this, but in those days, if you're from Dublin, it's like now being from Ethiopia. In terms, the world has got so much smaller now. But in those days, you know, there was like 1 or 2 record stores in Dublin, and they would buy a record a week, and they would all sit there. You know, it's like in Keith's book. You know, it was. You know, Keith and Mick would sit and, you know, listen to these records like prospecting for gold.
Yeah,
and
yeah.
They, you know, and you too were like that, because there was no, you know, radio in Ireland. They didn't have the wonderful liberal Radio 1 and all that stuff that we had.
So again, it's a case of having less is a good thing.
Yeah, having less is a good thing. Limitation is great for art.
Right.
Arguably, I don't know. And so they, and you know, they grew up, they musically grew up in public, you know. Right. I mean, the first time they really listened to the blues was on Rattle and Hum. And they thought, we have to do the blues. That's part of musical history.
So what, listening to B.B. King and so forth,
yeah.
That was kind of first time.
Pretty much. I mean, I know Adam didn't know how to play a 12-bar blues for years.
Oh, really?
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Because he'd come out of a different tradition.
Yeah, yeah, of course.
Right.
You know, and, you know, at the age of 14, I was playing the bass and playing blues songs. So I knew, you know, Sonny Terry and Browning McGee and all these. Right. I used to go to Melody Maker Blues at the Royal Albert Hall. You know, they put on these blue. I was a Melody Maker, man.
Right. So they were from a very different world.
Different world, and right.
And they also shared everything, didn't they? I mean, this business about sharing songwriting credit and so forth.
I don't know. I think
has that had an effect? Do you think?
Well, they share the things that they. You know, if you share everything and some no, they share the music. You know, but the music is only a third, I think. So they share a third 4 ways. I don't know much about this,
right.
But publishing is, I think, 3 things. I've never written a song in my life. There's
right.
the music, there's the lyrics, and there's the melody. So
oh, I see.
The music is split 4 ways.
Okay.
The melody, whoever writes the melody, gets that. And the lyrics, whoever writes the lyrics, gets that.
So you've never written a song? You've never, in all this time...
No, why be an average songwriter?
But producers,
I'm a bass player.
Producers have credits on songs all
I know,
over the place.
I've never been...
You've never said, I came up with the idea for that little bit. How about cutting me in for 10%?
Oh, God, no. No, because it's really stupid, but I thought, well, you know, I'll make my money from the sales of the records, little knowing that people would just...
To stop.
Stop buying and steal them.
Eventually, we come to that.
Yeah.
So so you two made you famous, didn't it, as a producer?
I think so, but I was the well-known guy before you. You know, I'd had the Peter Gabriel, I'd had a handful of hits by this point.
Had you done Simple Minds by then?
No. Simple Minds, this was my sort of... By the time War came around, I'd done War, and then I did Sparkle in the Rain and Big Country all around the same time.
Right.
I think then now we're into 1983.
Right.
And that was when I met Kirsty, end of 83.
Right. This is Kirsty McCall?
Kirsty McCall, my first wife.
Right.
And yeah, that's when we bought this recording studio that we're sitting in.
Yes, we're still sitting in the house in Ealing, where Stephen Kirsty...
Where I would... What we would do, we'd go to a very posh studio with all the musicians and just play. And Kirsty would do a scratch vocal. And then I'd come up here, and so that would cost a lot of money, because good studio, lots of musicians and stuff. Then I'd come up here and like, cut the clock time by, you know, by 95%.
Yes, yes.
Because we were working at home, but we had two small children who would come in, and, you know, if you work in your own studio, you know, there's no...
There's no limitation.
So I would just sit up here and edit between takes. I was, you know, as you can see, there's 24
still
track...
The huge grate.
The huge grate.
What was that? Sony tape machine.
Yeah, 24 track. And to be honest...
It's now a museum piece, isn't it?
It's a museum piece, and it's also being used as a storage space.
Right. But is this up here where she
was
doing
vocals? Yeah, she used to do all the vocals. Well, on pretty much all the records she did, till she died, my involvement was on...
Electric Landlady?
Landlady. No, what was the one before? The
Kite.
Kite. Which was named by Dave Gilmour.
Oh, really?
Who played guitar on Kite. And we said, you know, we need to sort of pay you. And he actually said this word. He said, send a kite. Ah, don't worry. Just send a kite to Armenia. Meaning, I don't know what that meant. Is a kite a specific amount of money? Meaning, like, I want you to give my... He never explained what it meant.
It's a denomination of currency in Armenia.
Right. Or is it a Cockney denomination?
Oh, right, yeah.
Kite, you know,
yeah.
I have a kite, mate.
A rocket. Yeah.
Yeah. I don't know. But Kirsty liked the term kite.
And it became called that.
And it became Kite. And then Electric Landlady. Then I sort of helped out on Titanic Days. But that was when our... Maybe that was named after our marriage.
Whoops.
But then... That was the end of that marriage, and and we all know historically. But you know, she was a fantastic artist, as you well know. And then for me, I was still wanting to sort of spread my sonic landscape. So you know, Frank Murray, this guy who managed the Pogues, approached me pretty much when I came back and worked with the Joshua Tree, I think, and said, Steve, you know, I've got this band. Elvis Costello produced their last album. You know, we'd love a proper producer.
So did you produce Fairy Tale of New York?
Yes, right. I did. And I did Kirsty's vocal in this very room.
Oh, really?
But not Shane McGowan's.
Right.
They never sung it together.
Really?
Yes.
And you don't feel like that kind of thing misses something? And that's the popular view, is that if they're not in the room together, it's not the same. Do you...
No, you don't make movies in real time.
Right.
You know, gigs are theatre, records are movies.
Right.
Possibly.
Okay.
You know, that you... Personally, my personal taste is that it doesn't... I always say it doesn't matter how long a record takes to make, as long as it doesn't sound like it took
right.
long.
Yes.
You know, and so as much as I can appreciate Def Leppard, I don't really ever listen to it.
Right.
You know, I mean, because it's just all craft and no art.
Right.
You know, and it's brilliant craft. And maybe the craft is art. Who am I to say? Right. But it just, you know, I much prefer some sort of chaotic meeting of atoms that makes something that you're not quite sure of, but it works.
So producers come in all shapes and sizes.
They do.
You know, very technical ones, engineering type producers.
Yeah, big fat ones like Rick Rubin.
Brian Eno, who, you know, Bald. Goes in and has great thoughts that nobody can quite understand and then get
No, not at all. Brian Eno is not the boffin you are. I mean, he is as down. I mean, it's funny. Me and him get on so well. And I'm just like guy who talks about tits, you know. And Brian, This isn't going into print. No one's going to listen to this.
You'd be surprised. Go on.
Oh, no, because... Okay. Anyway, no, they do come in all shapes and sizes, and it isn't really... Is it? In a way, it's like... It's a bit like, you know, when you say... It always annoys me when people say, do you like jazz? Well, jazz can be anything from, you know, New Orleans, traditional, lovely stuff, to the most unlistenable, avant-garde-clue type rubbish, to Pat Metheny. I mean, you know, it can be anything. Anything can be jazz. So, also, a producer, what does he do? I always...
So what do you do? What was your... My, what do you think your I tailor skill my, was? I, is...
My great skill is that I'm a good bloke, I think. I have a certain amount of little golden nuggets of things that I've learnt over the years. I'm certainly a jack of all trades. You know, I know a bit of music, I know a bit about the desk, but I steer. I always say the band builds the ship. My job is to steer it safely to port. Now, and to help decorate it.
Right.
Now, you know, the Titanic was a great ship, but there was not a good captain.
Right.
You know, so it's an important job.
So you've got to see the rocks ahead, the icebergs ahead.
Well, that's also a thing, is that I can see a problem before the problem appears.
Yes.
And I can steer around it.
Right. So you've
but
got
at
to
the
be
end of the day, it's... Oh, yeah, God, with the Stones, when I worked with them, I was Henry Kissinger.
So go and tell, which Stones record did you do?
The one I did was called Dirty Work.
Right.
It
of
had a song called Harlem which, Shuffle.
Now, I like Dirty Work. I may be in a minority here. I've forgotten that you've done that
I did
one.
Dirty Work.
There's had one hit
to the body.
I rather like.
Which was not a bad song, you know. It was one
which
of Keith's.
Which was a single, wasn't it?
Which was a single, and Harlem Shuffle got to number four.
Yeah. So, of course, that was when the relations between Mick and Keith
Keith and me was, well, Mick had just done that fucking disco album, which was affectionately known in the studio. And, of course, Keith, who is the most... a loyal person in the world, you know, in terms of throughout his whole life, he's just like he's a loyal person. For him, Mick doing a solo album was like him cheating.
Right.
You know, it was not that. Then, of course, Keith.
Then Keith did.
Well, you know,
himself.
Because if your wife cheats, then you're allowed to cheat. But he, you know, Mick was the one who cheated first.
Right.
You know, and Keith then thought it was okay for him to get his own back.
So did you have them in the room together when you were making that record? Or were they
probably
doing
for an hour over 6 months.
Really?
Oh, it was
really
ridiculous.
Seriously?
Yeah, really. It was not a...
So what, sort of rhythm section first kind of thing?
No, they were all jamming, but they... Well, there were two parts of the record. There was the first part in Paris, which was just the jamming, which was, you know, so many reels of tape and... To be honest, I learnt more about a great band than they learnt from me on that record. And it was like, imagine a whole series of cogs that where one of them's not working, nothing works.
Right.
Then all of a sudden, something clicks and this whole thing works. And that was like the Stones. I mean, but it would only work like 2% of the time.
Yes.
Now, earlier, it may have worked a lot more, but when it did work, there was like that little thing, oh my God, this was...
That's it,
you know.
So they'd start off just jamming.
Yes.
And you got the tape
blues
running. Though.
Yeah, we'd get the tape
just
running.
Just hoping that somebody comes up with something that could be turned into a song.
But they would always perform. Mick Jagger was, you know, he came from that world where, you know, you perform in the studio.
Oh, really?
Yeah. It was good fun. Nothing started till at least 1 a.m.
Right.
I mean, our days were pretty much like 12 hours difference.
Yeah.
You know, we'd work from... But we'd only work from 1 a.m. till 6 or 7. Then we'd go back to the hotel, sleep all day, get up, have dinner, and go to work.
So somebody would have a fragment of a song which you built into a song, and then somebody comes along with something.
And Harlem Shuffle, of course, is a cover version, so... And the solo of One Hit to the Body was played by Jimmy Page.
Right.
Who happened to just come to the studio. I mean, we would often get lots of... It was very uncool to have the door closed. That's one thing I learnt with the Stones.
Oh, really?
The door is always open, darling. Come in! And, oh, yes! And there was never any... what's the word? Where you... analyze. There was no analysis, ever.
I didn't talk about it at all.
No, very uncool. I always have the impression
I've read loads of accounts of Stevenson Studio, and I always got the impression they don't talk about it at all.
No, no, it's like musical. Do let's play another game of dice. Whoa, let's do having another drink, dear boy. Yes, and Ronnie Wood will tell a story, and everyone will laugh. And okay, let's go and play some music. Play some music and come back in, and of course, there was a song called Silver and Gold that Bono did.
Yes.
That was a charity record. Anyway, we wanted... Bono came up to the studio, and this was while I was doing the Stones, because I, you know, and he walked in, and I think we got the band to overdub on this song. And Ronnie Wood, I remember, was playing slide guitar with a knife, you know, because that's cool. And no one really knew who Bono was, and they came in. Because even though they were a big band, it was before Live Aid. It was just before Live Aid, because I went to Live Aid.
So this is my Irish mate who's turned up.
Yeah. but Keith didn't know anything. Mick Jagger wasn't there at the time.
Oh, right.
Mick would have known who Bono
Mick
was.
Would have known.
Yeah, exactly. Because, you know. But Keith didn't, you know, he lives in Keith's world.
That's true.
You know, I remember turning Keith onto Robert Cray, and then Keith suddenly, all of a sudden, is like, hey, you know, he found someone relatively new to life.
Contemporary.
You know. but you know, then Bono came in after they recorded on this, and Bono started talking, analysing it, and Keith just says, shut up, kid. You know, something like that. You know, because it was very uncool to analyse the music back.
Oh, sure.
You know.
It's really interesting. Yeah, that business about having visitors. Do you think that's possibly because they found it more comfortable with other people other than themselves?
Yeah, well, maybe. But there would be headphones lying around the studio in Paris, and these girls would come in and put the headphones on, and it would sound better in the headphones, so they would start dancing
right. And
stuff. It was very
strange. So you just sat there and kind of...
Yeah, and sort of steered. Yeah. But as I say, I was Henry Kissinger with... I'd have Keith coming up going, oh, I'll tell him this. And then Mick going, you go and tell him this.
Oh, God. And you were a lot younger than them.
Well, I was,
but
yes.
You weren't intimidated by them.
No, I wasn't. No, the one time I was intimidated, which was really, was on the Peter Gabriel album when Robert Fripp came in to do some guitar. Now, Robert Fripp had been the producer before, mm-hmm. on the album before. And you know Robert. Robert's like...
I haven't met him, but I understand right. he's not easy.
He's a big ego, you know. And, you know, he says there are certain people, you know, who hold the room, you know, and he was one of these people. And he was the producer on the album before, and on my album it was, you know, he was coming in to play guitar. At the same time, Kate Bush was out in the studio singing Je Sans Frontière on Games Without Frontiers, And they're sitting at the back, and I'm there, and I'm going, yeah, can we do it again, please? And no, we just need you to do it, and again, you know, and I'm coaching her through this part, and I hear this voice at the back going, well, something like, oh, I'm sure she's done it enough times by now, you know, and I'm young, right, I'm 25 years old, and I've got Robert Fripp behind me telling me that it's okay, and I'm going, it's not okay. I just ignored it. And that, like, I grew 10 years because I, you know, I was, like, shaking because it was like, I mustn't lose my nerve.
No, I'm sure.
But I did, and it was, and he has no idea that I was, you know, he was just said what he said. But this was a big thing on my, in my head, you know. I went from a boy to a man that day because I think, yes, I can be more confident.
Who's
now.
The most difficult act you've ever produced?
Oh, God. Difficult. I try not to work with difficult people because difficult. It's all about relationships. So I like to try and get a good relationship before I go in. I mean, I just recently worked with Jared Leto with 30 Seconds to Mars. He's a wonderful guy, but you know, I mean, crazy, crazy in an obsessive sort of a way. He's great though. Everything from him though is from here, and.
From the brain.
Well, yeah, from the brain, because he's an actor.
Yeah.
You know, and actors, basically, if we were in a movie right now, if this was a movie, someone would have made a proper decision, you know, a calculated decision to put these glasses here.
Yeah.
And that water would be half.
Very specifically.
Specific. Everything in a movie is like that. Well, making records isn't like that. But he takes that whole thing He looks at making records the same as making a movie. And so I was... And he would sit around playing acoustic guitar and singing, just like... And it was, and it sounded wonderful. And, you know, I would really wanted to you know, I would love to get that. But I've just remembered someone.
Go on.
Lee Mathers.
Oh, right.
The Lars.
Right.
Whose album I did. And he wasn't difficult because he was, again, a fantastically, and is a fantastic talent, but just very difficult to get his confidence, you know. And they're the only...
What, for him to be confident, or to...
Well, yeah, because I always think, you know, if I take on a project, it's my fault if it doesn't work. That's my job, you know. I can't ever blame anyone if it doesn't work. I mean, I would never say, oh, I should have fired the drummer. I would never say, I'll do your record if you fire the drummer. I just wouldn't do the record.
Right.
Who am I to say you should get... You know, right. Some producers love to be able to have to say, oh, I had to fire the drummer. I wouldn't do that. Muff Winwood wanted to sign you too. Said, fire the drummer.
And oh, really?
And Paul McGinnis said, but he formed the band. We can't fire him.
Right.
You know?
Because it used to happen a lot, didn't it?
Yeah. Yeah, but I don't, you know.
Right.
I don't have that sort of ego.
Yeah. So how has the producer's, you know, job changed in the last 10 years? Apart from the fact nobody's buying records.
Nobody's buying records. It's gone from that to that.
Yes, it's all on the screen.
It's all on the screen.
Something you look at, isn't it?
Yeah, a lot of people look at music. I've taken the decision that I am not going to look at music. I am going to still use my ears and employ part of my team to do the looking. So I know what all the looking does, but I am in that unique position where I use my ears still. Right. And it's a little bit... It's a little bit... not annoying, it's a little bit... You know... Sometimes I wish I could do all that, but I'm, you know, I don't want to be an, you know, but there are so many young kids who are so good at it,
right,
that I would rather use more of an overview of, you know, and use my experience because I've been doing it for 30, yeah. You know,
yeah.
I mean, I started in 40 years ago. Next year would be 40 years. So,
I was talking to a producer not long ago who said that it's very different nowadays because record companies want to get more and more involved because they can kind of look at it and they can constantly edit it and they can constantly come in and say, why don't you make that bit a bit louder or move that bit to the front?
Yeah, well, everyone's an average, you know. Everyone knows a little bit about it. And I don't know. The trouble with record companies is that the sort of middle class of record companies, which is the A&R men, they've gone. You know, they have scouts and they have presidents. And really, I mean, there's very few A&R men left. And, you know, when I was running Mercury Records here and I was also, I mean, I could sign things, but I still had to get it signed off by my boss, you know, and now even more so.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, the amount of major labels that's, you know, there's only like five people in the world who decide on, in the Western world, who decide on what's signed.
Uh-huh.
You know, if it's the head of Columbia, the head of, you know, in England, there's, you know, it's, you know, so you know those people.
So there's no, A&R men kind of saying that song could be better or...
No, I don't know. I mean, there are a few of them, but it's just an evolving thing. As I say, my son manages Ellie Goulding and... You know, don't tell him this is not a good time for music.
Right.
You know, for him, it's like, this is the golden age. You know, he's I think one of the differences now is an artist can make up for the shortfall on record sale royalties with some great sponsorship deals.
Right.
You know, which in my day, they were sort of frowned upon.
Mm-hmm.
You know, but now it feels no... It doesn't feel uncool at all to take 50 grand from Nike to go and play at their conference or something like that, you know. So good luck to them.
So can a producer be as busy now as they used to be?
Well, I'm not as busy. I don't want to be as busy. You know, I'm trying to keep my standards up. I mean, it's sort of laughable, really. I'm 56 years old. And when I started out, the thought of a 30-something producer was really old. Anyone in their 40s, no, forget about it. 50s, you know.
George Martin didn't work for a while, did he?
Right. Yeah.
He's got it too old. He's
exactly,
retired.
Exactly. So, you know, it's... I can't believe I'm even being considered, you know, I hate that horrible thing of, you know, trying to be hip when you're old, but
it's the game.
It's the game, right. You know.
I read recently you saying that you'd like to replace Simon Cowell on America's Got Talent.
American Idol, I think it was.
American
called.
Idol.
Yes, I did run a relatively public campaign.
That seems like...
And people did say, what the fuck? Why the hell do you want to do that? And I said, well, I feel that my personality would have suited it.
Right.
And, you know, whereas Simon Cowell is a half-empty kind of a guy, I'm a half-full kind of guy. So it would have been nice. And I'm still not giving up my entry point into TV in America.
And how would you change it if you
American Idol? I would be more... I wouldn't change it. I mean, I couldn't. People don't change it. You'd get employed to be part of it. But I feel my personality is conducive to something like that.
Right.
Especially in America.
And what was the thing... What would be the thing you'd most often found yourself saying to young artists?
It's a bit pitchy, dog.
I don't know.
But no, I'm not sure American Idol is, you know, that's probably the, I'm not, but in America it's amazing. There's this show called The Voice, which got amazing ratings, you know, and so there's still an appetite for music on television.
Right.
And I would love to be involved somehow in music on television. I don't know how yet, but you know, I have an agent in New York.
Right.
Yeah, I mean...
So don't give up hope.
No, I'd want to be a household name.
And finally, who do you wish you produced?
Oh, well, that question. Well, you know, obviously Springsteen around early days, Bowie again around those days. Mm-hmm. They were my heroes. And I always thought the Clash's records, except for Give Them Enough Rope, which sounded pretty good, were weak sounding for me. Vocals. I think I would have loved to have produced The Clash. And current bands, I mean, I love, obviously, Mumford & Sons and Fleet Foxes. And, you know, I think nowadays it's difficult for two guitars, bass and drums. You know, it's like the weakest art form, I think. You've got to have something else. You've got to have great harmonies. You've got to have something. Because... indie rock bores me to fuck, you know. It's terrible. No, it is. You know, I hate shoegaze. You know, be a bit more inventive.
Right. Steve, thanks very much.
Thank you.
It's been a David. Delight.
If you've been affected by any of the issues in this podcast, go to wordmagazine.co.uk or apply at your newsagent.